Dramatic political disagreements have continued in 2019, with Democratic control of the U.S. House leading to more head-to-head battles. The most intense led to the month-long partial government shutdown, as President Trump vowed not to approve any measure that didn't include $5 billion for a new border wall. It's another stark example that many point to as a lack of civil discussion among elected leaders, as some of their supporters encourage them to fight rather than compromise. As part of a series presented by ASU's School of Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership, former ACLU President Nadine Strossen and former U.S. Attorney General Michael Mukasey took part in the event How to Have a Civil Conversation Across the Political Divide. I sat down with the two of them and started by asking Strossen whether conversation today is less civil or if we're being naive when we assert that.
I think that we exaggerate the newness of the problem because when I look back on American history, we have had periods when not only physical violence, but even injury caused by physical violence was occurring rather regularly in the halls of Congress, among other public places. So I think the best known example is Charles Sumner being caned to such an extent that he was really incapacitated for months and even years. And we've had knives and other weapons brought into Congress. We used to have a history of dueling, as everybody who has seen Hamilton has been reminded. So I think that the tendency to think that, oh, it's worse and it's different than it's ever been is somewhat exaggerated. But I also think that is irrelevant. We have too much incivility. We have too little willingness to discuss urgently important issues with people with whom we disagree.
We are that way, largely because we define ourselves by our political system. We don't define ourselves by blood or land. And so we are arguing about who we are. And so it's natural to expect that that's going to excite passions. That said, I think that the internet contributes a great deal to it because it allows people to both sound off before an audience and to dehumanize the opposition. When I was Attorney General, unfortunately, one evening I passed out during a speech, and there was speculation on CNN, I think by their medical expert, that I had had a stroke. The internet was full of people delighting in the fact that I had had a stroke and hoping that I was paralyzed, hoping that I would die, and so forth.
You've seen that with Justice Ginsburg recently, too.
There you go. So that's part of what accounts for it, but it's not the whole of it by any means.
So what is it like having a commander-in-chief then who uses that as his method, whether people agree with what he says or not, the fact that he uses that to get the message out?
I don't think it helps. It exacerbates what's already there. But again, he himself has become a target of this, and is a whole, you know, is a center of it, not simply because he does it, but because he invites it, in part by doing it, and in part simply by his presence and the way he emotes.
So, Nadine, before I move on to something else, I want to get your perspective on social media and the president's use of it.
Any medium of expression can be used for good or for ill. And when I look back at the 18th century founding era in this country, when the main medium of communication was pamphleteering, those pamphlets were filled with the most vitriolic, insulting, condemnatory, hateful vitriol, even against somebody we now revered, George Washington, the father of the country. So I don't think the internet has profoundly changed that situation. But I think what is different about the internet is studies are showing that a high percentage, especially of young people, are spending more and more time on screen and less time in actual human relationships with other people. And I think when you interact with somebody in person, it's more of an opportunity to relate to them as a full human being.
In 1938, George Orwell expressed regret that he had been introduced to Stephen Spender because he used to caricature Spender as what he called a parlor pink. And he felt unable to do that because he had actually met him, and he was no longer a kind of cartoon figure, but rather was a flesh and blood human being. And that illustrates, I think, exactly what Nadine was talking about. And because people spend less and less time interacting with flesh and blood human beings, we get more and more of what we get.
Well, and people make that comment about how members of Congress don't hang out anymore, whether they come back to raise money for their district. Is that exaggerated, or is there the feeling that the relations are, they may be okay, but they're not as close as they were?
Oh, that's been true for a while. Mm-hmm. Congress used to, their families would hang out together. They couldn't go back and forth quite as easily before airplanes. Conventions, for example, were really conventions. They weren't simply staged pageants. People were getting together, interacting, and functioning. Now it's there's a lot of play acting, both during the session, obviously, and at conventions.
Here in Arizona, I have to especially, I would do this anywhere, but it's especially important to refer to John McCain. His passing was very sad in many ways, but in this context in particular, so many people remarked that it was like the passing of an era. He epitomized somebody who had friendships and cordial relationships, including with the two people he ran against for president, whom he famously, of course, invited to eulogize him. It's hard to imagine Donald Trump doing that.
You're obviously a free speech advocate. Have we reached a stage in any sense that, not that we want restrictions, but that we want to remind people that you're allowed to say hurtful things, but maybe you want to think about it before you say it?
I think that the state of free speech has always been challenged. It continues to be. A new survey was released just a day or two ago by FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, showing that, especially on college campuses, actually, there is too much of a call for censoring. Yes, I think we should raise our voices to criticize ideas that we disagree with, but we should not call for those ideas or those expressions to be punished by government officials, including university officials. And indeed, peer pressure can also go too far. If we're talking about Twitter mobs and online trolling, I think we have too much of a hair trigger tendency. If somebody says anything that is possibly, arguably insensitive, they are immediately denounced as a racist or a misogynist, and they're an evil human being. If you truly care about raising people's sensitivity and making them more egalitarian and more respectful of other people's dignity and equality, you don't do it by criminalizing their speech or even by condemning their speech. You do it by reaching out with empathy and compassion and education.
There's a recent survey also showing that upwards of 60% of people believe that they are uncomfortable talking about politics, talking about race, talking about religion with anyone other than people who agree with them, because they find that that the condemnation is so strong, they just as soon not put up with it. So there's no interchange of ideas. People shy away from it.
So are people afraid of other people's ideas?
People are afraid of other people's ideas, and they're afraid of other people's reaction to theirs. Mm-hmm. So people don't learn to defend their ideas and to analyze other people's ideas. They learn sound bites. They learn formulas. They learn slogans. Mm-hmm. But they don't learn argumentation.
Or critical thinking.
That's former Attorney General Michael Mukasey and former ACLU President Nadine Strossen. I spoke with them last week at ASU as part of the event, How to Have a Civil Conversation Across the Political Divide.